She's a model, a Playboy bunny.
Lori just drew men in.
But is the beautiful Bambi a killer?
They heard an execution-style bullet going in the back of their mother.
She was cold-blooded.
Or is she just a victim?
She has not had a fair trial.
She kept saying, this isn't real. It was a nightmare.
It's a case that spirals out of control.
You tried to jump out of the car at 60 miles an hour.
I'm a crazy mess. I've got this fugitive in my car.
It's a story which was so twisted.
She said, if you only knew what I knew, it would blow this town wide open.
In depth, insightful, in a class of its own. It's America's leading journal, Vanity Fair. Writers Bob Drury and Marnie Inskip want to know, was Bambi framed? Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It's 2 a.m. in the quiet residential neighborhood. 11-year-old Sean Schultz is terrified. An intruder is in the house.
Sean gets on the phone, calls a family friend. He described a man, maybe 6 feet tall, wearing a green jogging suit. He had a ponytail, but it looked like a wig. And he says, Mommy's been shot.
And the kid said they heard a firecracker, which was actually an execution-style bullet going in the back of their mother.
It was bizarre. The victim, Christine, was found in bed, face down. She had a gag in her mouth, and her hands were tied.
There is a high-caliber bullet hole in her back, entered her back, and burst her heart.
She had two young children. Having kids myself, I mean, I can't even imagine. Words can't express how they must have felt. Devastating, devastating. I don't think they ever could get over it.
30-year-old Christine Schultz is a devoted mother and the ex-wife of a local cop, Alfred Schultz. They were divorced just 6 months earlier.
The twisted nature of this story, two of the detectives to arrive on the scene to investigate are Fred Schultz, Christine Schultz's ex, and his partner.
Distraught, Fred Schultz comforts his traumatized sons, Sean and Shannon. They had tried to bandage their mother's wounds before calling for help. It's not clear if the killing was a robbery gone wrong or something much more sinister.
A couple of my detectives thought it was a pure assassination.
Just so many inconsistencies, things that didn't add up. Why was she tied up? Why was the bandana in her mouth?
We did look at her ex-husband as a person of interest.
He told him where he had been on that night. He said he and his partner were on a burglary complaint.
But investigators quickly realize that there's something odd about Detective Schultz's story.
He didn't tell us the full truth.
Schultz and his partner lied about where they were. He wasn't on a burglary call. He and his buddy, his partner, were with another friend drinking while on duty.
So Fred Schultz, he has an alibi, and he has a pretty good alibi.
Still, following department protocol, Schultz's service revolver and his off-duty weapon are sent to the state crime lab.
The off-duty gun was examined. That gun turned out to be the murder weapon.
He was taken by squad out to the crime lab, and it was explained to him that it was definitely the murder weapon. And on the way back on the expressway, he tried to jump out of the car at 60 miles an hour, banging his head against the window.
Fred Schultz swears he did not kill the mother of his children, and only one other person had access to his off-duty gun, his new bride, 22-year-old Laurencia Lori Bembenek. The gun was tucked away in a gym bag in their bedroom closet.
We started an investigation about her, and we find out that the night of the murder, she said she was at home in the apartment, so she didn't have an alibi.
She was so adamant that she did not kill Christine Schultz.
I interviewed her that night. She was so calm. She showed no emotions, not even nervousness. You watch for that as a cop. You know, you watch for knee twitch or eyes blinking too much. It made me think she was pretty cold-blooded.
Investigators charge Lori Bembenek with first-degree murder.
She kept saying, this isn't real. She thought that it was all going to go away.
Fred Schultz was standing by his wife, Lori Bembenek. He said, no, Lori would never have killed my ex-wife, Christine Schultz.
Lori Bembenek is not your typical murder suspect. How could a beautiful young woman with no history of violence commit such a cold-blooded crime?
On the one side, she was this poor, innocent little 22-year-old. And then on the other hand, this femme fatale, this slayer of men.
There used to be a Playboy Club on Lake Geneva in Wisconsin. She worked as a waitress in a little Playboy outfit with the bunny ears.
She did do some modeling. She was tall, thin, gorgeous.
She was the youngest of three sisters. She grew up on the south side of Milwaukee, Catholic background.
Her parents were salt of the earth people.
Her dad was a cop, became a carpenter.
Lori and I went to the same grade school together. We were the two tallest in the class, so we were always seated in the back of the room. We became kind of the class clowns at that point. But she was always a very good student, gifted artist, a gifted musician.
Lori Bembenek is 22 when she meets Detective Fred Schultz. He's 10 years her senior.
Lori meets Fred Schultz at a cop hangout bar called Trax. This was just a party scene.
Fred was very flamboyant. He liked to go clubbing and dancing. He was the center of attention, usually. His nickname was Disco.
He was kind of a Don Juan kind of guy, and, you know, Mr. Smooth and cool.
Laurencia found him just the sexiest guy in the world, big, rough, tough detective, and fell hard for him.
She was in love. She thought she was going to have a life with this man. I didn't see that. But again, you're not going to burst the bubble of your bestie. You know, you're not going to just say, this ain't good for you.
Just 2 months after they first meet, Lori Bembenek and Fred Schultz get married. Now, just 4 months later, investigators search for a motive. Why would she kill his ex-wife?
The prosecution's motive was Lori Bembenek liked to live in the fast lane, and she was totally angry that half of her new husband's salary was going to that woman, his ex-wife. And so she was going to get rid of Christine Schultz.
It was alleged that Lori Bembenek had been heard at dinner parties saying, oh, I wish Christine was dead. Somebody ought to take her out. As far as the prosecutor was concerned, Lori Bembenek dug through his gym bag, took out his off-duty Smith & Wesson service revolver.
The prosecution claimed that Lori put on a jogging suit and jogged over from the house that she had been living in with Alfred.
Then she broke into the house wearing a ponytail and a bandana across the face and shot Christine in the back.
The trial begins on February 23rd, 1982, and the case is a media sensation, especially when reporters find Lori's photo as a pinup girl, Miss March, in a Schlitz beer calendar. They dub the glamorous defendant Bambi.
It was in the press every day. The Milwaukee Journal would have headlines with her. It was all sensationalized.
She became international news. I mean, literally international news. It was the way she looked. It was her red fingernails. It was her blonde hair. It was her vivaciousness.
To the prosecution, the case comes down to three pieces of evidence. the murder weapon found in Laurie's apartment. A strand of Laurie's hair, said to be found on the bandana that served as a gag. And a wig disguise, discovered in her apartment complex that matched the description of the one worn by the killer.
The theory was that Ms. Benbenek had flushed the wig down the toilet.
In their apartment complex, they shared a plumbing pipe with a neighbor. That neighbor called a plumber one day, said, "My toilet's backed up."
The plumber gets into a soil pipe, and in it, they found a wig.
Benbenek's team puts up a spirited defense, especially when the only eyewitnesses in the case take the stand, Christine's sons, Sean and Shannon.
The boy described the shooter as muscular. He says that it's not Laurie Benbenek, whom he knew. Son thought it was a man.
But Laurie did not do herself any good on the stand. She was just like an ice maiden. She just spoke in monotone, just did not really have any kind of veracity or passion to try to get herself off.
For days, the jury is deadlocked. Then, on March 9th, 1982, the verdict is in.
May the jury find the defendant, Laurencia Benbenek, guilty of first-degree murder.
Judge sentenced her to life imprisonment.
To me, it was open and shut case. She said she was home alone and the gun was there.
As she heads off to prison, Laurie Benbenek insists she is not just innocent. She was framed.
My belief is the fix was in. The fix was in.
Laurie Benbenek, age 23, sentenced to life in prison for murder. Her new home, Wisconsin's Tachita Correctional Institution. Her new name, inmate 131524A.
She was scared. She kept saying, "This isn't real. It was a nightmare."
Making matters worse, Benbenek's husband, Police Detective Fred Schultz, stops visiting her.
Fred continued to profess Laurie's innocence up through her sentencing. And then gradually, within a year, he had turned around and he was convinced that Laurie Benbenek had killed his first wife, Christine Schultz.
The day the trial was over, he was in a bar drinking, apparently, according to his mother, going out with other people. He sent her a note just saying, "Laurie, goodbye and good luck." He divorced her and moved to Florida.
Desperate to prove her innocence, Laurie begins drafting the first of many appeals.
She appealed, trying to get a new trial, because she firmly believed she was completely framed by the Milwaukee police.
In fact, Laurie Benbenek was once a cop herself. It was her dream job.
She was accepted into the Milwaukee Police Academy. It was the best moment in her life.
Laurie always looked up to her father. He was a police officer. She was very proud of that.
But after only a few months out on the street as a rookie cop, Laurie is fired.
She went to a concert. And she was with her friend Judy Zess. And Judy Zess apparently was caught smoking marijuana. They accused Laurie of it, and Laurie denied it. And they didn't care, they fired her.
The firing enrages Benbenek. She claims she's a victim of discrimination.
The good old boys club just didn't want infiltration of women. Why was a woman taking a good job away from a man?
And then Laurie gets a hold of these photographs of police officers at a picnic in a local park, men and women, full frontal, dancing naked on picnic tables. There's cocaine there, there's alcohol there, and there's children there. So she goes to the Internal Affairs Division and said, "You fired me on someone's word that I smoked marijuana, which I did not. So what are you gonna do to these guys?
The Milwaukee police take no official action. But when federal agents learn of Bembenek's allegations, they open an investigation into the department.
She was contacted by an attorney for the Justice Department. He suspected Milwaukee authorities were receiving funds to promote the hiring of women and minorities, and then they were being terminated in their probationary period.
The Milwaukee Police Department denies the charges.
There was no history of that within the department. That didn't hold any water.
Next thing you know, dead rats are appearing on her windshield. Her car is being scrawled with a key.
She believed they just hated her, and they were covering it all up, and it had been going on for years.
But that investigation collapsed when she was charged.
The Justice Department said once Lori Bembenek was convicted of that murder, our case fell apart.
8 years into her sentence, Lori Bembenek's life and her appeals are going nowhere. That's when she meets 34-year-old Dominic Gugliotto.
Dominic's sister was in prison for a drug violation. Dominic met her when he went to visit his sister.
Everybody notices Laurencia. So of course I did. And I said, she's a good looking girl. She had it going on, for sure.
Dominique was really kind of Lori's type. He liked the outdoors, he was sexy.
I looked her right in the eye. And first question I asked her when I met her in Tichita was, did you kill Christine Schultz? And she said, no, I did not.
Soon, Lori and Dominic start trading letters and calls.
She sent me drawings. We're both Leos. So she drew a picture of a lion, and I'll share that with you. It's a tattoo. It's on my arm. And her name, Laurencia, was written there. I felt she loved me as much as I loved her.
Devoted to Lori, Dominic watches as she slowly slips into despair. The first two appeals have been rejected. And then, on June 20th, 1990, the ruling is handed down on Bembenek's third and final appeal.
There was nothing but crying and tears because the appeal was denied. And I said, what are we gonna do to get you out of here? And she turned to me and she said, really? You'd do that? You'd help me escape? And somehow, it turned into a yes out of my mouth.
p.m. The guards are conducting their nightly bed check. Lori Bembenek is nowhere to be found.
Lori is in the laundry basement. She takes the window out and squeezes out the window.
Under the cover of darkness, Lori sprints for the fence.
She's running across the yard and gets to the woods. She took a belt, wrapped it around the three strands of barbed wire. As she's going over, one of her thighs got caught and she cut her leg. Now coming down Golf Course Road, and now I'm driving slowly, and I blink my lights like I'm supposed to so she knows it's me. Once I have her in the car, you can't even imagine the adrenaline that's going through me. You know, she's kissing on me, and I'm a crazy mess, you know, because I've got this fugitive in my car.
The couple pose as newlyweds on their honeymoon. With just married stickers and bells hanging off the bumper, they drive across the Canadian border.
And we pulled over, probably 2 miles down the road, and celebrated.
Soon enough, Lori and Dominic settle into a new life in Canada, working in a little diner in Thunder Bay, Ontario, under assumed names.
We were Anthony Gazzana and Jennifer Gazzana.
She loved Thunder Bay, and it's a pretty little town.
She walked into a restaurant right across the street from a police station and got a waitress job.
From the way Lori described it, it was bucolic. Long walks in the moonlight, picnics in the park.
We were loving the freedom. She was smiling pretty much all the time.
To Wisconsin law enforcement, Lori Bembenek is a convicted murderer on the loose. But news of her daring escape has made Lori a folk hero, a worldwide media sensation. The tabloids call her Bambi, the icy blonde bombshell. And many are convinced Bambi is innocent.
She has not had a fair trial.
The media was insatiable. They couldn't get enough. There were t-shirts out there, you know, run, Bambi, run.
She absolutely loved it because that's the purpose of this whole thing. This is an attention getter for her case.
Then, in October 1990, 3 months after Lori and Dominic crossed the border, a tourist in Thunder Bay spots a familiar-looking waitress from an episode of America's Most Wanted. Royal Canadian Mounted Police are moving in to arrest the notorious fugitive killer, Bambi.
We know that we're not going to be on the lam forever. This is not a forever deal. We knew this going in.
Dominic Gugliotto is convicted of helping a criminal escape and sentenced to 1 year in prison.
I feel that Laurencia used me as a pawn to complete her escape. She just got her freedom, and I never heard from her again. You know, it still kind of hurts. I get why she did it, but it hurts still the same.
Behind bars in Canada, Bembenek continues to insist she never killed anyone. But can she prove it? The whole world is talking about an audacious prison escape by a convicted murderer the tabloids have dubbed Bambi. Vanity Fair writers Marnie Inskip and Bob Drury follow her story from the beginning.
Marnie had been on the Bembenek case when she was first found guilty of murder and sentenced to life in prison.
I knew a lot about her story. She was somebody who was almost larger than life to me.
So, 10 years later when Laurencia escapes, now the story explodes again. And I say, if we can get in to see Lori Bembenek in that Canadian jail, we got a story.
Bembenek agrees to meet the reporters. They come face to face in a guarded visitor's room.
Bob and I go in, and from the minute I looked at her eyes, I said to me, this woman knows exactly what she's doing. This woman is very calculating and very shrewd.
Lori had an effect on men. There was a certain attraction that she sent out like a wave of pheromones that just drew men in.
She was always kind of looking at Bob, and she was playing to Bob. She definitely was flirting with him, and I, as a woman, you know, can definitely see that.
Bembenek tells Inskip and Drury that she's thrilled a distinguished Canadian lawyer has agreed to take on her case.
Frank Morocco was a serious, very high-profile immigration lawyer in Canada.
I said, well, first, she has to take a lie detector test. And I want the lie detector test done by someone I know who does polygraph examinations for the Canadian military. He reported back to me that, in his opinion, she was telling the truth.
Lori Bembenek is scheduled to be deported to the United States to serve out her life sentence. But Frank Morocco, the lawyer who wrote the definitive work on Canada's immigration code, comes up with a novel idea.
She had already lost her three appeals. So the only way he saw to keep her out of Wisconsin jail was to have her classified as a refugee who was being unfairly persecuted. Lori's claim was that the Milwaukee Police Department was a hotbed of vice and dirty cops, and they had banded together to pin the blame on Christine Schultz's murder on her.
It was Lori Bembenek who leaked pictures of naked Milwaukee cops partying in the vicinity of minors. The woman who was a key witness in the federal investigation of the department.
I believed at that time that our system was a fine-tuned, well-run situation, and boy, was I wrong.
Private investigator Ira Robbins is convinced Lori Bembenek was framed. He's been working on her case since 1984, and mostly for free.
I believe it's my calling to try to straighten out some of this stuff, and that's what I do.
Mr. Robbins was passionately committed to her case. He had a trunk full of documents, which he had brought up here for us to look at.
For Robbins and Morocco, there's a checklist of dubious evidence that implicated Lori in the original prosecution. Starting with the blonde hair supposedly found on the bandana that the killer used as a gag.
When the medical examiner examined the hairs found at the crime scene, she did not find any blonde hair. She said so in her report, and yet, miraculously, at the time of the trial, there's one blonde hair in the sealed bag.
I have a question. How did it pop up in evidence? The fact of the matter is, it seems to be planted.
Then there is the question of the wig disguise from the murder, found in the plumbing of Bembenek's apartment complex.
The theory was that Ms. Bembenek had flushed the wig down the toilet and it had got caught in the drainage.
But one neighbor claims Fred and Lori's old friend Judy Zess might have been involved, although Zess herself denies it.
She said that Judy Zess was the last person to actually come in and use the bathroom. And literally, the day after that Judy Zess was there, the toilet became plugged up.
And there were other troubling details in Zess's testimony.
Later on, apparently, Ms. Zess said that she had been induced to try to incriminate Ms. Bembenek.
Bembenek's attorney got a sworn deposition from Judy Zess where she claimed that she had been pressured by the police.
And finally, there's the murder weapon, Fred Schultz's off-duty gun. According to the judge and jurors, it was the key to the entire case. Morocco brings in a team of experts to compare the size and shape of the gun's muzzle to the wound on Christine Schultz's back.
Dr. John Hilsden Smith, who was the chief pathologist and who testified in murder cases in Ontario many, many times, in his opinion, the imprint on the body was 264% greater than the muzzle imprint of the so-called murder weapon.
He had four premier experts say it was irrefutably impossible for that to have been the murder weapon.
If the so-called murder weapon is not, in fact, a murder weapon, there's absolutely nothing left of the case against Lori Bembenek.
Back in Milwaukee, the district attorney is faced with Bembenek's accusation and the new evidence.
So much pressure was put on that the Milwaukee PD was forced to reopen the case, and the case was flawed.
A judge examining the evidence gathering in the original case finds what he calls serious blunders.
What Frank Morocco did was to basically indict the Milwaukee PD and the judicial system there.
I think the Milwaukee PD, the Milwaukee District Attorney's Office, just wanted this to go away. Let's just get this woman out of our hair.
The district attorney offers Lori Bembenek a deal.
They agreed to vacate the first-degree murder conviction, and she pleaded no contest to second-degree murder.
It was a deal. You accept the second degree, and you'll be released on time served.
She was very concerned that her father would die without knowing that she was released. She wanted him to know that it was over and that she was free.
In December 1992, Lori Bembenek, the flashy blonde, now a polished brunette, emerges to meet the U.S. press for the first time in more than a decade.
But I just wanted to say how grateful I am to the team of lawyers and all my other supporters that have worked so hard for so many years and never gave up even when I felt like it. And this is just the best day of my life.
Some wonder why she accepted a no contest plea after spending more than a decade insisting she was innocent. But her close friends say they understood.
She had been through a lot. She had 11 years taken away from her. I think she thought, is it worth fighting anymore? Get me out of here, whatever it takes. Just get me out of here.
Lori Bembenek gets her freedom. But one nagging question remains. Who really murdered Christine Schultz?
The problem overall is that if she didn't do it, somebody else did.
The key evidence that convicted Lori Bembenek of murder has been discredited. Now, Vanity Fair writers Bob Drury and Marnie Inskip have one question. If Lori didn't kill Christine Schultz, then who did?
One of the oddest of many odd aspects of this story was that 35 days after Christine Schultz was killed, Judy Zess was robbed.
There were exact similarities between the Judy Zess robbery and the murder of Christine Schultz. Bound the victim, they held the gun right up against the body.
The facts almost fit to a T. The intruder wore a green tracksuit, a blondish red wig, tied back in a ponytail. Not a very similar MO, the same MO. And this time they caught the guy, and it was Fred Hornberger.
Fred Hornberger is an ex-con with a rap sheet for manslaughter and armed robbery. Lori Bembenek claims it was Hornberger who killed Christine Schultz, and that someone hired Hornberger to do it. Someone inside the Milwaukee PD.
My old man was a cop, so I was aware that cops are not the saints that most people think they are.
All the cops and the drug dealers went to high school together. I mean, it was a small town. So they all, like, socialized at the same bars. Trax was one of them. It was wild. It was the 70s, 80s. We heard that there were lines of cocaine sitting on the bar. They'd have prostitutes in there.
Fred Hornberger and Fred Schultz ran in the same bar crowd, but he tried to play down his relationship with him.
Bembenek tells Marnie Inskip that Schultz has a history of violence.
Christine's divorce lawyer said that Christine had come to him and said that Fred had beaten her, and it was a nightmare living with him.
There were police reports indicating that Christine Schultz was afraid of her husband and that she thought he might kill her.
Christine's lawyer said that Fred was so upset that this woman was in this house with his children that he built with his own hands. And to make matters worse, she was going to marry another cop. So that really made Fred boil.
Lori came right out and said, "I believe my husband, Fred Schultz, hired someone to kill his first wife, Christine Schultz."
In fact, Bembenek claims she's convinced that Schultz paid Fred Horenberger to murder his ex-wife, and that his brothers in blue helped cover it up.
The title of our piece was Bambi Framed. There's no question in my mind that she was.
Entire police department. Good cops, bad cops, cops not involved. They all knew what was going on, one way or the other. When the ballistics, which put her away, came back as bogus, it just points to a frame up.
It's too important an investigation to try some foolish thing like trying to cover it up. No cover up, absolutely not.
Fred Schultz, to this day, denies any involvement.
He vehemently denied that he had anything to do with Christine Schultz's death.
Fred Schultz declined to participate in this program. Fred Horenberger died in 1991 during the commission of another armed robbery. Police will not say whether Horenberger was ever questioned regarding the murder of Christine Schultz. Then, years after Lori Bembenek's conviction, her former friend makes a shocking statement in a deposition.
Judy Zest made these cryptic comments like, "If you only knew what I knew, it would blow this town wide open."
While investigating the Lori Bembenek story, Vanity Fair writers Bob Drury and Marnie Inskip uncover a startling statement from witness and former friend, Judy Zess. It had been submitted during one of Bembenek's appeals.
Judy Zess made several cryptic comments, like, "If you only knew what I knew, it'd blow your shorts off."
Zess says she knows who really killed Christine Schultz, but she refuses to clarify her statement or reveal the killer's identity. She declined a request for an interview. Still, many are not sure justice was served, including the original trial judge.
"I am convinced that the public will never know or find out in absolute terms who fired the shot that killed Christine Schultz."
It's a story which just was so twisted. To this day, I still don't know really, really, and I don't think anybody really knows what happened.
But there is one piece of evidence that may hold the key to who really pulled the trigger 3.5 decades ago. Evidence of blood and semen at the scene of Christine's murder were logged, but never revealed at the time.
The serologist took swabs from the body of the victim and reported that there was no seminal material found on any of those swabs. We found that, in fact, they had found semen on 6 of the 8 swabs.
The evidence was suppressed. There was blood on the walls, and there was sexual contact. And that was never brought up in the trial. What does that say to you?
They weren't interested in solving the crime. They were just interested in keeping their conviction and covering everything up.
Today, there are DNA capabilities that we didn't have. So I would do that analysis just to try to put the matter finally to rest.
That would be awesome. I believe the evidence is there.
Until then, just who murdered Christine Schultz remains an open question. But Lori Bambi Bembenek will never see her name cleared. In November 2010, at age 52, she dies of liver failure. Some say it's the murder sentence that took the greatest toll.
It's a sad tale. I think that really she was just totally spent. She was just exhausted by life.
She fought till the day she died to prove her innocence. She wanted to clear her name.
I'm confident that Bembenek was the assailant. I thought she should have served more time because to me it was like an assassination.
Over the course of the 18 months working with Ms. Bembenek, you come to know a lot about the person. She felt very strongly about issues important to women generally. And I just found it impossible to put that attitude together with the idea that she went into a woman's house and executed her.
Lori needs, still to this day in the afterlife, to be proven innocent. And hopefully whoever did kill Christine be held for the devil.
In the end, we just really don't know who killed Christine Schultz. And I wish I knew. I would love to know.